Good morning to our audience on Blog Talk Radio. I am your host, Marlon Aldridge, and welcome to Talk Unchained. We're going to continue our show tonight concerning the Palestinian-Arab-Israeli conflict, and we're going to be joined by our guest, Professor Moshen Kani, Professor of Geography at St. Clair Community College here in Dayton, Ohio, and we're waiting for him to come on the line. On the last show, we talked about the history of Jews in Europe. We talked about their migration to what today is referred to as the State of Israel. Of course, we talked about the events that led up to the situation that we have now, where we have virtually a continuing conflict, and our current president has exacerbated those issues by recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So we're going to talk about that. I see that Mo's on the line, so we're going to bring Mo in, and we're going to continue our discussion from last week. Mo Shenkani, how are you doing today?
Good evening. I'm doing well. Thank you. How are you?
Great. I'm glad you could continue this important conversation with us. Of course, we hear most of the events that are happening in that part of the world via the news, and we can't be quite sure sometimes whether or not we're getting accurate information. So I think it's going to be important to have an academic like yourself to help us sort of find our way through this mirage of information. So just for the benefit of our audience, let's go ahead and have you introduce yourself again, and then we'll continue this conversation.
Well, I'm, as you mentioned, as you said, my name, Moshen Kani. I teach geography at St. Clair and adjunct at Wright State. I've been teaching geography overall for about 23 years, 3 years in Michigan before I moved to Ohio, and then for the last 20 years in Ohio. I was born in Iran, and I moved to the U.S. when I was 16 in Michigan, where I finished high school, and then went to university, got a degree in agriculture and degree in math, and then geography. So that's kind of a very brief background of me. I've traveled around the world. I've been to Israel. I've been to the West Bank, Jerusalem, and around that area. So I have personally witnessed some of the things that go on there. And then I have traveled to roughly about 40 countries altogether around the world.
Oh, great. Okay, great. You make a great addition to our show, at least from an academic perspective, and we love to have that on the show. On the last show, we talked about the history of the Jews in Europe for the most part and the subsequent migration to what we refer to today as the State of Israel. And, of course, for those of us that have been watching the news, we know that our president chimed in and did something that other presidents were not willing to do, and that was to recognize Jerusalem as the seat of the government for the State of Israel. So we're going to go into that, but let's sort of backstep a little bit. But on the last show, we went through a little bit of history. We talked about the conflict that happened during both World War I and World War II, which basically led to the UN Resolution 181 partition plan, which pretty much was supposed to have given about 18% of that land in that particular area, which we refer to as Palestine. 18% of that was supposed to go to the Israelis, with the remaining part going to Transjordan, which today is Jordan, and some other little slices in there as well. So let's start here. Describe why did Palestinians Palestinians not complain about the establishment of the Transjordan, which was later renamed Jordan, as I had mentioned earlier, but complained about the establishment of the state of Israel, which only, like I said, comprised 18% of the UN Resolution 181 partition plan.
Yeah, I think what we have to be careful about is, of course, where Palestinians were dominantly living. And when we talk about the transition zone, the areas of where the UN partition was, the UN partition of 1947 really focused on a smaller area. It was after Jordan had been created. It focused dominantly on the area of Palestine, which now comprises the state of Israel and the occupied territories. And by occupied territories, I mean mainly the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So of that partition in that area, when the UN decided to partition that area of Palestine, or Israel, today's Israel, and the occupied territories, and what is the source of really the conflict, is that that partition was to give the majority of the land of Palestine, about 56% of that land, to Jews, who comprised at the time roughly about 30% of the population. So if we look at the area of conflict, what it is today, and if we look at the maps today, the area of Palestine was, even though the Palestinians comprised about 70% of the population, when the UN proposed its partition plan, only about 43% of the land was supposed to go to the Palestinians, about 56% to the Jews, and then the remaining 1% was to be Jerusalem and the immediate surroundings, where it comprised about 1%, and that was supposed to be internationally monitored by the United Nations. So the problem arises from that point, where you have a minority of population that comprises less than about 30% of the population, occupying at the time in Palestine area about 6 to 7% of the land, being given 56% of the land of Palestine. And not only that, but also a lot of the land was very agriculturally productive. Now, a lot of people argue and mention, oh, well, we have the Negev Desert in the south. And yes, Negev is desert in the southern part, but Negev was also strategic in one, that it gave Israel a port of Eilat at the bottom, at the most southern point, to access to the Gulf of Aqaba and to the Red Sea, and it also kind of separated the Arab Muslims from the east and the west, so you would have not a continuous territorial Arab continuum where Egypt would be on one side and then you get to the other side and you would have Israel, or you have Saudi Arabia and Jordan on the other side, so the Negev would be kind of a buffer zone in the middle. So that's the area that I think we should focus on, and that's the area that is the main source of the problem, is that the partition plan was not done amicably in a way that the of the area at the time indicated. So that's
okay.
That's the problem.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the conflicts that came after UN Resolution 181. I'm thinking in particular the Arab-Israeli War. Let's sort of talk about that and what were some of the advantages gained by Israel, if any, and what were the disadvantages, if any, to the Palestinians?
Well, I think, again, I think we would agree that if were, or if anybody, if you comprise 70% of the population, there was going to be a partition plan to give you a state. Demographically, the way that the territory should have been divided, you should have been given the majority of the territory. Of course, the Arabs were not. And as a result of that, they rejected the whole idea of UN partition. When they rejected the partition, of course, Israel unilaterally declared its independence in 1948, May of 1948. And then, of course, you had Russia that recognized it, and then the United States, I believe literally 11 minutes after the declaration, recognized the state of Israel. And, of course, on the other hand, the Arabs rejected the whole existence of the state of Israel because it was unilateral and it was not something that they could accept with the partition. So they amassed armies and they attacked Israel, which resulted in the first Arab-Israeli War of 1948-1949 war, in which the Israelis, of course, won the war, and as a result of the war, they actually expanded their territory by 50%, so they occupied some of the territories that was supposed to be part of the initial state of Palestine. So they expanded their territory, and that resulted in roughly about the creation of about 700,000 refugees from the area where Palestinians were forced to leave the area. So state of Israel actually expanded after the 1948-1949 war. And then, of course, there were other wars, 1956 war, where...
Let's stop for a minute, because we have some conflicting numbers here, and I just want to make sure I understand what's going on here. The way I understood UN Resolution 181, the partition plan, is that only 18% of the land in that particular area was supposed to go to the Jews. And it seems like you are telling me that that number was higher. And I had read somewhere also is that east of the Jordan River, that area was designated to Palestine, the Palestinians.
Correct. But,
so
but
this
that would
be...
Correct. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want to make sure that we're sure on the numbers, because you're giving me a larger number than what I was able to find, and I just want to make sure that I'm clear in terms of UN Resolution 181, because there were some other resolutions that came after that, and I want to make sure that we're providing the right information in terms of the brokering that was done via the UN.
I think what we are talking about is that maybe we are talking about two different areas. The area of trans by 1948, when the state of Israel had been created, state of Jordan had been established, and it had been established as the area east of Jordan River. West of Jordan River, you had west of the Jordan River, which the Jordanians controlled until the war, and then of course they lost the war and they lost the control of that area. But what is really really important again to keep in mind is that the area that we're talking about that is a source of problem is not the Transjordan area or Jordan east of the river. It is the area Jordan, or it's the area west of Jordan River, which now includes the West Bank and the State of Israel and the little tiny Gaza Strip along the Mediterranean.
Gotcha. Okay. So I think I was confusing the Palestinians with the Jordanians. So the Jordanians were promised the area east of the Jordan River. And then, of course, the west side of the Jordan was the area which was supposed to be partitioned. Or should I say,
yes, and that's where the Palestinians resided. And that's where the problem arises today from. So the partition was that area of Palestine west of the Jordan River.
Okay. I'm still trying to figure out how could a future country with not that many residents in place prior to its establishment defeat all of these armies that Arab armies that came together to fight this newfounded land. I'm trying to figure out. It seems to be some collusion somewhere in there. I can't see a smaller army defeating a larger. I would imagine, and I could be wrong on this. Disabuse me of this notion as well. Were the Israelis fighting a larger force, or were they the minority in terms of military strength, military numbers?
The numbers were actually debated kind of in terms of who was the larger number, but the state of Israel, of course, has had continuous support of the United States. So I'm not sure without the support of the United States that the state of Israel would have been able to defeat the Arab armies. So there is support, and there has been continuous support from the United States to Israel since its establishment. And we could get into that later on, how that came about, if we have time. But if you talk about even the 1956 war, 1967 war, and 1973 war even, when the Arab armies actually kind of advanced for the first time against the Israeli army, it's been continuous military and monetary support of the United States that has, of course, enabled Israelis to remain in that area and have one of the largest and most advanced militaries in the world. I believe they have the third or fifth largest military in the world. I'm not sure exactly, but I know at one time they had the largest fleet of F-16s outside of the United States. So this is a military that is extremely, extremely well-prepared, very modernized, and very well supported by the United States. And it has been continuous.
Wow. Wow. Of course, we want our audience to participate. If you have questions or comments, the call-in number is 515-605-9891. Again, that's 515-605-9891. Press 1 to get in the queue. If you have questions, please, no speakerphones or listening to the show on another medium, as this will present feedback in the podcast. All right, let's continue. We need to talk about, let's go ahead and talk about some of these subsequent wars. We want to work our way toward today. We definitely want to discuss what President Trump did. What was the primary effect? Number one, probably hopefully we can go into some of the reasons why he would have done that, and what are the effects. And then what is the backlash? And then we want to come forward and talk about what are some of the possible solutions as well. So we're working our way forward. You mentioned the 1967 conflict. Of course, the State of Israel was established in 1948. And I think one of the impetuses for that, I know that the British had the mandate of sort of managing at least being a part of the governance, which was to come later with the State of Israel basically just declaring themselves as a state. And I think part of that had to do with the British appeared to have lost interest. Do you have any comments or any additional background that you can shed on that?
Well, you know, last week we talked about the Balfour Declaration, right, which set the foundation for the creation of Jewish state in Palestine, although it called for a creation of a Jewish homeland without really prejudice against people who already lived there. But political Zionism that had started in Europe really needed the support of a very large superpower. And that's where the United States comes in, because the Jews really in Europe significantly worked to get the support of the United States to back the creation of the State of Israel. So what, in a sense, what I'm saying is that when the Jew political Zionism started in Europe, even though the Balfour Declaration was written in 1917, prior to that, the Jews were trying to get the support of the British for the creation of Jewish state in Palestine. But really, the British were not all that keen about it. So what the Jews did was to reach out to the United States and work with the British and the United and the Americans, and they kind of created this organization that if they could get the Jews in the United States to get the United States to enter the war in and help the Allies on the side of the Allies, that the British will ultimately support the creation of a Jewish state. So they worked tirelessly in the United States to influence and organize the Jewish support in the United States to help and to convince the United States to enter the war, and in return they would have the British backing and support for the creation of State of Israel. So fast forward, 1948, the State of Israel, of course, is created. There's a 1948-1949 war, and then we progress through 1956-1967 war, which is a preemptive war by Israel on the Arab countries, and that's when the occupied territories come in. So it is in that war where Israel occupies the West Bank, Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai Peninsula. Now, through negotiations with Egypt and signing the 1979 Camp David Peace Accord, ultimately the Sinai is returned back to Egypt, and Egypt becomes the first country to sign peace accord with Israel. But the remaining territories remain as occupied territories, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. The Gaza Strip was returned in 2005 unilaterally by Israel, but they still have a blockade on Gaza, and Gaza is one of the literally poorest areas in the world, most heavily populated, densely populated, and extremely, extremely poorly run and very poor. And then you have the West Bank, where now the Israeli settlements have expanded into the West Bank. So fast-forwarding through that, and then you have...
I want to let you continue that, but I want to make sure that the audience understands what the Israelis actually gain. Now, you just told us that Mount Sinai was actually in possession, was land held by the Egyptians.
Correct.
So we're looking at
Sinai Peninsula was part of Egypt, and in 1967 it was occupied by Israel.
And then you mentioned the Golan Heights. Who was that held by?
Syria. The Golan Heights, if you look at the topography of Israel, the Golan Heights sits at a higher elevation. That was an area where the Syrians could overlook into Israel and, of course, attack Israel. So that area was occupied in 1967 and then annexed by Israelis, and they still control that area as well.
Okay, so that was a strategic point then. From a military standpoint, the high ground is always going to be a strategic point. So I want to make sure we understand who the combatants were. We had Israel on one side, and then the Egyptians and the Syrians. Were there any other combatants in the war of 1967?
Well, Jordanians as well. Jordanians as well, but they were not as organized, not as well, organized pretty much as the Israeli military was.
Okay. And that's to be understood because each of these areas, I'm assuming, maybe with the exception of Egypt, would have been under the mandate, would have been managed by the man, by the mandate powers. Is that correct?
Well, the mandated power, they had become, by 1948, of course, they had become independent. But independent in a way that they really had not established really a very old state yet. I mean, they became independent in 1946, so you have, and then 1948-1949 war, and then you have 1967 war. So, and you know, these were individual countries, so they were not, there was not that much coordination or organization among all these individual militaries, right?
Okay, okay. And that's sort of what I'm getting at, is that these were relatively new countries from the standpoint that they were occupied by the Ottoman Turks, and we don't really know, at least I don't know, unless you can provide it to us, how they were actually managed under the Ottoman Turks. And then, of course, World War One came in, and the Ottoman Turks lost that war, of course, along with the Germans lost that. And so we had this, the mandate system was set up in order to manage some of that territory. So we're looking at this organization that was taking place at least since 1917 up until what you're saying is 1948, somewhere around that period. Just want to make sure that people are understanding at least the historical aspects that are going to lead us up to contemporary times. So we want to make sure we understand that. And then you said, go ahead and finish what you were saying about the West Bank, Arab East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. Talk to us about that a little bit so we can understand from there during the 1967 war.
Well, during the 1967 war, then, as a result of that war, the Israelis occupied those four areas that I mentioned, right? The Sinai, Golan Heights, the West Bank, and Gaza Strip. Right after the war, the United Nations passed the Resolution 242. And the Resolution 242 ordered the immediate withdrawal of Israel from the occupied territories, which today we're in 2018, and Israel still occupies the West Bank and Golan Heights, and that is in violation of the UN Resolution 242. So that occupation is against international law. So if we believe in international law, and we take international law as the backbone of what international relations is, in a sense, then this occupation is an illegal occupation.
Okay. Okay. Are you
now
still
I
there?
Can, yes, I'm here.
Okay. It looks like you sort of faded out there a little bit. I want to clear up. I want to make sure I understand one thing here, as regards to Jerusalem. Now, the Arabs had East Jerusalem prior to 1967. Is that correct?
Jordan. Yes.
Okay, and so they also, during 1967 then, the Jordanians lost East Jerusalem.
Correct. Well, in the 1948-1949 war, right, they lost the area of west of the Jordan River. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I'm talking about the 1967 war and Arab East Jerusalem. Did the Israelis occupy East?
Okay, so you're talking about Jerusalem specifically. Yes, in 1967 war, the Israelis occupied not only the West Bank, but they also occupied Jerusalem. Yes.
Okay, I wanted to establish that because we're working our way forward today. And we're going to talk about the events of today. In particular, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to educate us on the significant Trump's declaration of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So we want to talk about
right.
that. As a matter of fact, let's go to that now. What are concerning this region? What are some of the most significant events subsequent to the Arab-Israeli wars?
Let me understand if you want to reform that question. What do you mean by what are some of the subsequent events? Maybe you can
after
clarify that.
The let's say it like this. After Resolution 242.
Correct.
Subsequent to Resolution 242, the UN Security Council Resolution 242.
Correct.
Yeah. Basically, at this, you can speak to any events that you think are significant, or educate us to some mm-hmm. of the things that we need to know in order to understand what is actually going on in this particular part of the world.
Okay, so in 1973, there was another war, which to the Arabs is known as the Ramadan War. Israelis, it's known as the Yom Kippur War. So that was another war in 1973. In 1979, of course, you had the first Arab-Israeli peace accord of Camp David. The Palestinian Liberation Organization was created in the 1960s. And that, a few years later, Yasser Arafat became the chairman of the PLO. The PLO was recognized as a terrorist organization by Israel and the United States. So there was no immediate or direct talks between PLO, in a sense, and Israelis. And the intermediary became Egypt. So anytime the peace process would happen or the peace talks would happen, it would go through Egypt. In 1990... So fast forward, I'm trying to kind of give it subsequent but timeline, but not too detailed. In 1990, for the first time, there was a direct talk, although in hiding, between the PLO and Israelis. In 1991, went to Oslo, and they went to Oslo and they signed what came to be known as the Oslo Peace Accords in 1991. The Oslo Peace Accords, in a simple, to put it simply, it was kind of exchange of land for peace. So the Israelis would, in sequence, would relinquish some of the territories in the West Bank for the creation of a Palestinian state, and in return, the PLO would withdraw from its charter the destruction of the Strait of Israel and would recognize the State of Israel. So that was the Oslo Peace Accord. In 1993, after they had hashed out all the details, they came to the United States, and under the Clinton administration in 1993, on the lawn of the White House, they signed signing of the Oslo Peace Accord into what became known as the Declaration of Principles. So Yasser Arafat was there, the Palestinian chairman, and Yitzhak Rabin at the time was the Prime Minister of Israel, and they signed the peace accord and they went back to implement it. Unfortunately, in 1995, when Yitzhak Rabin was given a speech about the peace accord and trying to get into his motorcade, an Israeli Jew who was against the peace accords walked up to him and shot him and assassinated Yitzhak Rabin. And that was pretty much, I remember the exact date because the signing was September 13th, 1993. I was in D.C. on September 14th, 1993, the day after the signing had taken place. And I got to meet Al Gore, and I saw the members of the Congress, and there was a real excitement that finally there might be a peace coming. And then it all went out the window with the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. Since then, there have been other attempts. And again, if we had time, I could go through the time, 1998 Wye River Agreement, the 2000 Accords, which a lot of people say, oh, in 2000, the Israelis offered Palestinians pretty much everything they wanted, and Palestinians rejected it, and they used that as an excuse that Palestinians never wanted peace. And then, of course, when Obama came to office, he said that, backtrack a little bit, in 2000 that happened, in 2001, of course, you had 9/11, and the Arab-Israeli conflict kind of dropped in the background. Nobody paid attention to it after the World Trade Towers came down and the war on terror and all that. That kind of took a back seat during the Bush administration. When Obama came back in, he said he was going to have a hands-on administration and he's going to bring the Arab-Israeli conflict to an end. And he attempted. He actually stated the two-state solution as the only solution for peace. He indicated that the settlements were illegal. That was the position of the United States. At the same time, he gave one of the largest military aids to Israel. So while we are saying that, in the background, we are giving everything to Israel that it needs. If we were so Israelis had no really pressure or no incentive to stop the building of settlements in the West Bank or really to come to negotiation for peace in a real way. And then we come to Trump.
Let's stop right there. I have to take a station break, and then we will come back and let you start where you finished off. Let's go ahead and take a quick station break. We are discussing the Palestinian-Arab-Israeli conflict. This is part two on Talk Unchained.
Hey, where you going? Don't hang up that phone. Stay tuned. We about to make it do what it do. Here with Uncle Woo, AM360. Because you can't stop this movement. AM360 is happening. Hey, Wally Ali, I'm remaking this song, buddy. Watch out now. You can't stop this movement. AM360 is happening. Hey, Super Uncle Woo Show, y'all. Live music. Open discussion. Students of Imam W.D. Muhammad. And other guests. Give you the correct picture. You got the conscious connector. Uncle Woo. And I do what I do. AM360. Check us out.
We are back on Talk Unchained, discussing the Palestinian-Arab-Israeli conflict with Professor Moshe Nkani. Mo, go ahead and finish your last thoughts.
Well, I was just kind of giving you a very, very quick and brief, I mean really, really brief, kind of a timeline of the policy of U.S. administrations in the Middle East. I think during the Obama administration, he was viewed as someone who was not in support of Israel. He did not have very good relationships with Benjamin Netanyahu, and I think they really wanted him out of office. It's very interesting because I remember just a couple of years ago, well, more than a couple of years ago, when the U.S. signed the nuclear deal with Iran, Israel was extremely, extremely, extremely disenchanted with the United States, extremely angry with the U.S. And they called this, of course, the worst deal that has ever been signed in history. And they wanted that deal to be dissolved and thrown away. So while the Obama administration rejected that and continued with the negotiations and the treaty with Iran, very interestingly, behind Obama's back, some of the Republican senators invited Benjamin Netanyahu to come and address the U.S. Congress.
I remember that.
Yes, this is very unprecedented. It never happened before that a foreign leader will come to the United States, to the U.S. Congress, behind and without the president, the knowledge of the U.S. president, and will address the U.S. with regards to its foreign policy. This was unbelievable, and I remember Benjamin Netanyahu trying to tell the United States what we should do in the Middle East and how we should totally tear the Iranian nuclear deal, that it is absolutely awful, and so on, so on, so on, so on. So when we look at the relationship was not very smooth at all. So the Israelis always wanted someone else rather than Obama to make sure that they truly, the way they wanted to, support Israel unconditionally. And, of course, in that they saw Trump, because he, of course, advocated the support of Israel when he addressed AIPAC and talked about how strong the U.S. relations are with Israel. And he indicated that they will. That was one of his campaign promises, that if he becomes the president of the United States, he will move the Capitol. Now, he is not the only presidential candidate who said that. I remember Newt Gingrich, when he was running for president, he indicated that that would be the first thing that he will do after the inauguration, that he will move the capital from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So it's not the first time that it's been said. It's not even Obama had stated that. And that had been the position of the U.S. Congress. But no president had come out and officially had made that statement or made that position of the U.S. Administration until Trump, of course, announced that just about a month ago or so, a few weeks ago or so. And when I teach about the Arab-Israeli conflict, I always talk about the fact that there are so many obstacles to the U.S. to the peace accord, peace treaty between Israel and Palestinians. One being, for example, the refugee problem. Another very significant issue is the settlement issue, the water rights. Always it seemed that those could be addressed, but Jerusalem would have its own unique place, that we could discuss all the other stuff, and then when we have resolved all the other stuff, we will come and we'll discuss Jerusalem because of its significance, historical significance, religious significance, and all that. So this seemed to be the biggest obstacle. And to come and indicate that, yes, we are moving the capital to Jerusalem and we are moving our embassy to Jerusalem, and then in the same breath talking about the fact that there's going to be a peace accord, this shows the short-sightedness and the lack of understanding of the Middle East and the conflict. Palestinians cannot compromise about East Jerusalem as their capital. There is a Israeli state, the West Bank, the West Jerusalem can be their capital if they want. But if there is to be a Palestinian state, East Jerusalem is their capital. And to simply say that this is a unified capital of Israel, it's just very short-sighted, very uninformative, very foolish in my view. And, of course, I believe many experts who understand the Arab-Israeli conflict will also indicate the same thing. Now, we don't know what that really means in terms of real status, where the borders are going to be, how the Palestinians are going to have access to their to their sites or not, or if it's anything is really going to change. But the whole notion is dangerous. The whole notion of Jerusalem as an undivided capital for Israel is a very dangerous, dangerous path to go down.
Let's back up for a minute, because I still have some misunderstandings here. Israel is a sovereign country.
Correct.
Are you saying that they were they already operating their capital out of East Jerusalem?
Not East Jerusalem. It's very interesting. Jerusalem after 1967, when they during the war, it was two Jerusalems. You have East Jerusalem, which is often regarded as what we call occupied Jerusalem, and then you have West Jerusalem. And West Jerusalem was, of course, part of the state of Israel. So East Jerusalem was always designated as the future capital of Palestinians. Because if any of our listeners have been to Jerusalem, you know, you have the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and you have the Wailing Wall right there, and you have the Dome of the Rock right there, and then you have the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is the most significant areas to all these three major religions. And that's why the United Nations ultimately decided that this cannot belong to one religion or one country. It has to be open to all the three major religions. So
okay, I understand that part, but I'm trying to.
Right.
I'm working my way toward this. I'm trying to understand how the leader of another sovereign country can make this declaration, and it have some significance. It seems to me, my thought was that they were already operating. The Israelis were already operating out of East Jerusalem as their capital. I don't understand. I'm trying to understand how could President Trump make a declaration, and all of a sudden it becomes so. Explain that to me. Were they already operating their capital out of East Jerusalem, or was it Tel Aviv? Now, if it was Tel Aviv, how can the declaration of Trump make it so? Make it a reality?
Right. Okay. So the let me see if I can simplify this and clarify this. The political capital of Israel, where the embassy, where the U.S. embassy was or is Tel Aviv. So that's the political capital. The cultural, historical, religious capital, they always regarded Jerusalem as that, right?
Okay.
So Jerusalem has been this historical capital. So East Jerusalem is occupied, is regarded as occupied. So they were not, while the Israelis have always claimed that Jerusalem is their capital, the international community never recognized East Jerusalem as part of their capital. They always believed that if there is a Palestinian state, East Jerusalem, which they recognize, which by the international community is recognized as an occupied East Jerusalem, will be the future capital of Palestine. So while the Israelis have always indicated Jerusalem is their capital, it's never been really their capital, the entire Jerusalem. West Jerusalem, okay. East Jerusalem, not so. So if I go back several years ago, when Ariel Sharon actually went to East Jerusalem and stayed in East Jerusalem, stayed in a hotel, it created riots because the Palestinians saw that as an indication that the Israelis are going to claim East Jerusalem as their capital. So there was a riot, and one of the people who was actually with Ariel Sharon was killed. So the Palestinians, the Arab countries, and the international community does not recognize East Jerusalem as part of capital of Israel. They recognize that as an occupied East Jerusalem, and that's how they refer to it. So they refer to it as East Jerusalem. And if you go there, you can actually see literally two cities. You can see East Jerusalem as an occupied, oppressed area, and then you can see West Jerusalem, which is pretty much controlled and free by under the control of Israelis. So they occupy East Jerusalem. It is occupied, but by declaration of Trump indicating that Jerusalem is the capital, what he's saying, in a sense, and what the Arabs take it and how the Palestinians will take it, is that what he's saying is that now it's not East and West Jerusalem anymore. It is the entire Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Does that make any sense? Clarify it a little more.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, but I still don't understand how his declaration can make that so. Is the international community now supporting President Trump?
No, overwhelmingly, in the United Nations, it was rejected. His declaration or his statement was totally rejected. And I think the only country that was in favor of that was the United States. So the other countries rejected the idea of what he had indicated, what his declaration was. So no, the international community does not support it. However, since the United States has been the biggest and most powerful supporter of Israel, it's the statements and the actions and the policies of the United States weigh tremendously on what really happens in the area. And if we continue with that a little bit, it actually puts the United States in danger. It puts the men and women of the armed forces or Americans in danger because it just creates a lot more anti-American sentiment.
That's true. And I think also because of that declaration, the United States will now be moving its embassy from Tel Aviv to East Jerusalem or somewhere in Jerusalem. Is that correct?
Yes. In fact, I believe I heard just last week or so, Nikki Haley indicating that by 2019 or 2020, the embassy is going to be moved. They're going to start construction of the embassy in Jerusalem. So, yes, I think what they're saying is that they and Nikki Haley actually indicated that they don't really cater, they don't pretty much care what the international community says. This is the position of the United States and the United States sovereignty, and this is our position, and we're not going to back. And in fact, the United States has threatened. Nikki Haley said, we're going to take names of the countries that actually vote against the United States. So we are kind of bullying other countries. We are threatening other countries that you either vote for us, with us, or there's going to be consequences if you decide not to vote with the United States. And that is very problematic. And this reverberates in the entire Muslim world as to if the United States talks about being an honest broker in the Arab-Israeli conflict, we certainly don't act as an honest broker. We give Israel over $10 million a day. That's American taxpayer money that goes to Israel, over $10 million a day. We give Israel the largest portion of our foreign budget, and Israel brutally occupies and oppresses the Palestinian in the West Bank and in Gaza. If there is going to be a solution to this Arab-Israeli conflict, I think the United States, if it talks the talk, it needs to walk the walk. Although now we don't even talk the talk, really, but we need to be a real honest broker. The state of Israel does exist, and there is security issues to be considered and all that. Yes, absolutely. Any anti-Semitism should be combated. Any extremist groups should be combated. But what we don't want to do is to oppress one group of people just because of the way we look at and the relationship that we have with a group of other people. And I have to say this, and maybe some audience of our audience will take issue with that. You know, historically, the Holocaust was a totally dark part of human history, and anybody who wants to deny that, I would call them anti-Semitic. So Holocaust should be remembered. However, it was not the only Holocaust. It has not been the only Holocaust. We've had other Holocausts. We have Holocausts happening right now. We have genocides happening right now. But it seems like politically, and this is the political Zionists, not all Jews, but political Zionists seem to have used the issue of Holocaust to evoke everything around that, to have every right to oppress others because of what happened to them during the Holocaust. So it seems like often we say the oppressed become the oppressor. It seems like now Israelis are literally doing to Palestinians, maybe not the Holocaust, of course, not to that extent, but a system of ethnic cleansing. And it seems like we support it. And I take an issue with the U.S. policy here that when we talk about human rights, when we talk about equality of people, when we talk about rights of people, then what about the rights of Palestinians? Where do we stand for their rights? They want a state. They have a right to a state. Where is their state?
I get that. Now, at least from a historical standpoint, I've always wondered if the United States and Britain, for that matter, or France, were to criticize the Israelis too much, their refrain could always be, well, you're a colonialist. Look what you did, at least in look what you did in the United States. That was that wasn't ethnic cleansing. That was genocide.
Correct.
So I've always wondered, was that a popular refrain from government officials in Israel? Should the United States try to, you know, criticize them a little bit too harshly, and Britain and France, because all of these are former colonizers?
Mm-hmm.
And we need to understand, too, that according to the records, 3 million Jews actually migrated from countries in Europe. We're talking about Russia. We're talking about Britain. We're talking about France. We're talking about Spain, actually immigrating from all of these different places. Now, of course, the Russians were not as harsh. I mean, they were harsh, not as harsh as some of the other countries. And we had mentioned on the last show the expulsion of Jews from England in 2090, and from France in 1391, from Austria 1421, and from Spain 1492. So this persecution had been going on in Europe for many years, and we don't hear much about that. It seems as though they didn't want the Jews in Europe, and I've always thought it could have been because of a conflict of religions. Of course, the Catholic Church was very strong and prominent in Europe. Regardless of where you were in Europe, the Catholic Church pretty strong. And I've always wondered if they did not want a rival religion in Europe. Have you heard anything to that effect?
If you go back in history, there have been many reasons. But I think if we come to the modern times and we talk about why we can't criticize Israel, and I think this is what we should focus on now, the history of Jews has been contingency, as we talked about last time, a history of persecution. And there's no doubt about that. But if we come to this present time, at the moment, I don't think it's the fact that if we criticize Israel or Britain criticizes Israel, they will turn back and say, you know, you were colonial powers. However, you know, after 9/11 and how the United States engaged in the so-called war on terror and justifying everything that as a war on terror, right or wrong, it seems like Israel has taken a page out of that and indicating that whatever they do to the Palestinians is what they're doing against terror. So the Palestinians are terrorists, and whatever they do is justified, even if it's not really justified. So they have this comeback at the United States. Look at what you're doing, anywhere you want to. You invade Iraq, even though the reasons did not exist, because of the war on terror, and you're telling us not to do it, and we have a right to defend ourselves. So I think the real point to make here is that in the United States, the Arab-Israeli conflict has been projected to the American population in a way that Israelis are the ones, or Jews are the ones who are the victims, and they are surrounded by these aggressive Arab countries, Muslim countries, that simply want to push them into the sea and annihilate them, like what Hitler wanted to do. So this is what I'm talking about when I talk about the fact that they evoke the Holocaust in that sense to justify what they do. And in a sense, the Israeli lobby, which is extremely, extremely powerful in the United States, AIPAC, which is extremely, extremely powerful in the United States, evangelical Christians for Jews, who are extremely, extremely powerful in the United States, there is a lot of power here that influences our policies toward Israel. Unfortunately, there is not, unfortunately or fortunately, however you want to look at it, there is not such lobby for Palestinians. So we hear one end of the story, and it's portrayed to us in one way, presented to us in one way, but the reality on the ground is a totally different issue. Now, again, I must, again, I think, emphasize that this is not being anti-Semitic. This is about policy. There are many Israelis who have served in the Israeli Defense Force, IDF, that have rejected, and they have resisted, and they have resigned, and they will not serve in the occupied territories. There are many rabbis and Jewish scholars who talk about the fact that Zionism is literally everything about political Zionism is against the religion of Judaism, that the Jewish nation does not have to have a place to call Jerusalem as its capital. The Jewish nation is a Jewish nation. Wherever they are the Jewish nation. I will mention one more point. You know, many people will say, you know, Israel is continuously attacked by Hamas or Hezbollah and these extremist groups. And that is true. And I don't support the extremist groups such as Hezbollah or Hamas. However, if we could honestly broker a peace accord between Arabs and Israelis that would give Palestinians a state, we could marginalize the extremist groups on the fringes. Because at that point, they will not have anything to stand on. Today, Hamas can stand on the fact that the Israelis are occupying their land, so we resist. Hezbollah can indicate that the fact that they are resistance to the Israeli occupation. If there is no Israeli occupation, there is two peaceful states side by side, we could marginalize Hezbollah and Hamas and the extremist groups even more. And we could target them even more.
Sure.
But the way it is, we cannot do that because they have some reason that they are fighting and resisting Israeli occupation. And it is a brutal, illegal occupation. I want to be very, very clear about that.
Okay. Well, let's use the last part of our show. I know you had wanted to talk about possible solutions. So let's hear your views on what some of the possible solutions are. And you sort of intimated it that the two-party state, but what is the pathway forward to the two-party state, at least in your opinion?
Well, in my opinion, of course, there are issues that have to be resolved on the ground, right? So there is the issue of refugees returning. There are many Palestinian refugees that are still living in refugee camps since 1948, and they would like to return to Palestine if there is a Palestinian state, just like Jews came back to their own state. So that's one issue. The issue of water has to be decided, because water is a very significant issue. We don't often talk about it, but water is very, very significant. If you go to the West Bank area, when the settlements are built, Israeli settlements are built, they have access to water, they have green lawns and all that stuff. On the other hand, Palestinians have to have a permit to dig a well, and often they're not given permit, so their land or farmlands or olive groves go totally, totally dry in a sense, and they're uprooted by Israelis for new settlements. There is the issue of settlements. How do you get rid of settlements? How do you deal with settlements that are strategically spread out through the West Bank, throughout the West Bank, that connects all Jewish settlements and often excludes the Palestinian population? And it's dissected the Palestinian population. So how do you deal with that? And I think to deal with all that, and then, of course, the issue of Jerusalem as well. I think the U.S. is, and by many experts, has been an obstacle to peace rather than a broker for peace. We have talked about it. We have attempted, but attempts have to be balanced. We cannot support Israel unconditionally and then tell the Palestinians, if you want peace, you have to engage in direct peace talks with Israel. The balance of power is not there. The Palestinians do not have the power, the military power, the capital power, to engage in a balanced negotiation with Israel. So is it that I engage in some negotiation with someone who is much more powerful than me, and they can dictate the notion of what kind of treaty is going to be? So the United States, if there's going to be a peace accord, and if there's going to be long-lasting peace, I believe that the United States has to look at its policy between Arab and Israelis. Just to bring the two sides together to sign a peace accord is not enough. It has to be balanced. It has to be fair. It has to be looked at as to the fact that if Israelis are building settlements in the West Bank, and we say as our official policy those settlements are illegal, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to impose sanctions on Israel to say, you can't do that? We're going to impose economic sanctions, military sanctions, until you stop building settlements or dismantle them? I think until we do that, I don't see a path to peace. I really don't. The peace process is nowhere to be found today. It's nowhere on the table. And Trump just a few days ago indicated that if the Palestinians don't come to the table to negotiate for peace, we're going to cut funding to the Palestinians. I mean, this is not how you negotiate. This guy says he is the ultimate deal broker. This is not how you broker a deal. You don't force people into negotiation where the negotiation is not, there's no balance of power in the negotiation.
That's true. Now that sounds familiar. We can look to the United States and see there's definitely not a balance of power, at least from the standpoint of black-white relations, white-brown relations. This is happening in the United States. Now I'm sitting up here thinking in terms of honest brokerships. I mean, you could mention the United States, but I'm thinking about Israel. And here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking about when the British wanted. They had control of the Suez Canal,
mm-hmm.
which is up near Egypt. And I'm thinking about they wanted to get control of that and engage with Israel to actually attack
Correct.
the Egyptians. Now, this is something that many people don't know about. And so the Israel decided to do something totally different. They ignored the British.
Right.
And actually seized control of some of the areas in Egypt to the dismay of the British. And so in terms of honest brokership, I mean, that has to be on all sides. The United States has to be an honest broker. Israel has to be an honest broker. And we've seen here where Israel has, at liberty, taken land that was not theirs. And that's why we refer to it as occupied territories today. So there has to be honest brokership by all parties involved. And if we look at history, that doesn't appear to be the case on any side where there's honest brokership. We're at the end, and I appreciate you joining us and enlightening us on an issue that we hear about a lot, and we're not quite sure, at least I haven't always been sure, that we are getting some honest or critiques, you know, both positive and negative on either side. And so I appreciate you joining us here tonight and enlightening us on some of these issues. We're at the end of our show. I'd like to thank our guest, Professor Moshe Kani. I'd like to thank our audience as well for listening in. And if you'd like to listen to past episodes of Talk Unchained, you can visit blogtalkradio.com/AmericanMuslim360 and search for Talk Unchained or Marlon Aldridge among the on-demand episodes or in the search box near the top of the webpage. I'd like you to tune in to more informative, thought-provoking broadcasts on AM 360 tomorrow morning starting at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time for critical issues with solutions, money sense, and a new day for Al-Islam. This is Marlon Aldridge. I welcome you back next Wednesday, and each Wednesday at 9 p.m., same place, same time, same intellectual stimulation. Spread the word about the show and follow me on Facebook. Until next time, peace be unto you. Assalamu alaikum. Thank you, Mo.
Thank you very much.